You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Last year, Columbia Records released another in their series of rare recordings by Nobel laureate Bob Dylan. This volume is called The Bootleg Series, Volume 14, More Blood, More Tracks, and it focuses on the recording sessions for his 1975 album, Blood on the Tracks, an album many critics call the finest in Bob Dylan's long career. Here's an early recording of a song called You're a Big Girl Now.
Our conversation was short and sweet. It nearly swept me off of my feet, and I'm back in the rain. And you are on dry land. You made it there somehow. You're a big girl now. Bird on the horizon, sitting on a fence. He's singing his song for me at his own expense. And I'm just like that bird, singing just for you. I hope that you can hear hear me singing through these tears. Love is so simple, to quote a phrase. You've known it all the time, I'm learning it these days. Oh, I know where I can find you. In somebody's room. It's a price I have to pay. You're a big girl all the way. Time is a jet plane, it moves too fast. Oh, but what a shame it is that all we shared can't last. I can change, I swear. Ooh, see what you can do. I can make it through. You can make it too.
You're a Big Girl Now, Bob Dylan, from the album Bootleg Series Volume 14, More Blood, More Tracks. This 6-CD box set contains some beautifully written notes by rock historian and singer-songwriter Jeff Slate, who joins us now. Jeff Slate, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, everybody, and it's good to be here.
Bob Dylan wrote Volume 1 of his memoirs about 10 years ago now, called Chronicles Volume 1, and I think Volume 3 will come out at some point. But
in true Wilbury fashion.
But I think in that book he talks about the making of, I think it's Oh Mercy is the one he talks about. But by, I think he's telling us the story of Blood on the Tracks or any of his records. He's talking about the creative process. And that's kind of what you take us through with on Blood on the Tracks and on these notes. So set Blood on the Tracks up for us in the history of Bob Dylan.
Well, certainly by that time he'd been incredibly well known for a decade, which, and in a different way than pop stars, for want of a better way of saying it, had been known. In other words, you know, the Beatles had been similarly famous for a similar amount of time. Elvis had certainly been famous at a, you know, high level, Sinatra, people like that. But Dylan was known in a different way. you know, that the whole voice of a generation thing, as much as anything, set him apart from other recording artists of the era in a way that was more literary, more heady, more, you know, not in the traditional pop star mold. So he was inventing the job in many regards. So by the time 1974 comes around and you have this sort of ascendant singer-songwriter thing going on with Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and Jackson Browne and whoever else, Leonard Cohen, you know, Dylan had already been doing that for more than a decade. And he had that mid-60s period with the Thin Wild Mercury sound where he made, excuse me, Bringing It All Back Home, Highway 61, Blonde on Blonde, which were unlike anything else before or after in many respects. But then had retreated, you know, had made a very clear decision. And it's interesting you brought up Chronicles, because I was thinking about, when you asked the question, that passage in Chronicles where he says, you know, he had the motorcycle accident, but he really just needed to get off the treadmill. And so he went away, went off to Woodstock, led a very domesticated life. You know, he had people climbing on his roof and trying to get into his house. You know, he was still Bob Dylan, but I think he was able to live a much more normal life for at least a minute. And he made some records that were not remotely of the moment or of the zeitgeist relative to what other artists at his level were making. I mean, you know, John Wesley Harding and Nashville Skyline were completely different than what the Beatles and the Doors and the Rolling Stones. I mean, they were really apart from that. And so flash forward a couple of years, he made Planet Waves. You know, he broke with Columbia. He I think, wanted to, you know, greener pastures. You know, he met David Geffen, who was starting Asylum, and he made Planet Waves, and he made did the big tour with the band. Both of those were number one records, but I think, and the tour certainly made everybody millions of dollars, or certainly Dylan. But I think for most people, even though they were number ones, were less satisfying than maybe they expected of Bob Dylan. And I think whether consciously or consciously or unconsciously, he saw all these other people dubbed the new Bob Dylan around him and knew that he could certainly do it better and differently. And so after he came off tour with the band, why, I don't know why he did it, but he really did set about writing songs and kind of rewriting the rule book for doing that. In other words, he had, you know, he had played with words, but it had always been within the construct of sort of normal folk or pop songs, rock and roll songs. And with this, he was taking, because he was taking painting lessons and he was interested in the arts in general, he was really interested in the Cubists and Picasso, and he was trying to think, how can I do with the 3 or 4 minute song what Picasso does with his paintings? Which is, you know, pretty bold. I mean, you know, you think about the competition at the time, people were just trying to write something catchy or to push the boundaries with regard to poetry or subject matter. He was literally reinventing the rules without discussing it with anyone. This is just all in his head. He wasn't looking for anybody to say, that's a good idea. He was just doing it, just following his muse, so to speak. And so, you know, he sits down both in New York City and Minnesota with this little notebook, and he's writing these songs, and they're completely different to anything else. And when he plays them for Mike Bloomfield, Stephen Stills, people like that, I don't think at first, from by all accounts, they really knew what to make of them, because I think they were different. You know, I mean, I think they were hard to follow, and, you know, if you were just hearing this from the, oh, I'm going to play my new record, plays them a couple of songs, they're dense, they're intense, they're, you know, you're expecting Highway 61, or even If Not For You, and you're getting, or Forever Young, and you're getting, you know, Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts. It's a, you know, there's really no correlation almost. Even though it's a story song, it's completely different. So, you know, the interesting thing comes when he gets to the studio. And by all accounts, what we had known as people who were interested in Dylan was that he showed up on that first day with this band of guys who had played on the Deliverance soundtrack and, you know, didn't like what he heard, and one by one, he fired them. And what we found when we got the session notes out and the multi-track tapes and his notebook and so forth was that wasn't the case at all. You know, he had gone in there, and the first day, he was all by himself with an acoustic guitar and a harmonica. And the evidence that we had was that when he recorded these versions, although he did change his voice a little bit in the delivery, his playing was virtually the same every time. In other words, when he got to the solo section, he played it exactly the same every time. When he got to the harmonica section, he played it exactly the same every time. And what we kind of struck upon was he was really looking, and John Hammond said as much after the fact, he was really looking to make a solo acoustic record. And it was sort of a, you know, freewheeling for 1974, 75. And then subsequently, the idea was hatched, well, you know, maybe it would be good to have a little flavor and bring some musicians in. And then that didn't work out. But I think his intention and the record he heard in his head, at least at the outset, was very spare. And I think that's because the songs he was writing, you know, were different, and that type of performance suited them most of all.
Then at the last minute, he kind of rethought it and re-recorded five of the songs.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, this is where, like any Dylan scholar, you get into conjecture. So the story had always been that he went out to Minnesota, played it for his brother, and his brother didn't like it, and convinced him to bring in some local guys. But I think the reality is slightly different. You know, he'd lived with that record for about 3 or 4 months at that point. They cut it in September. There were acetates floating around to Bob and people within the record company at Columbia in October, November. Ratso Sloman did his preview in Rolling Stone in late November. And Dylan heads out to Minnesota with all of that, you know, swimming around in his brain. And I think, you know, I think the stakes were pretty high for him. We think of him, you know, maybe he makes these decisions rashly, or he doesn't make the right decision, but I think he was well aware that there was competition, and that to release a record that, and he was also back on Columbia Records after a break. And so to release a record that, you know, was all in the same key and was very moody, with FM radio really pushing records at that point, I think he was aware that that might be a cool record that would be loved by many. He wanted to reestablish himself. And this is me, you know, I don't know for a fact. But he wanted to reestablish himself as Bob Dylan, you know, big, bold Bob Dylan. by the same token, I think he had lived with those mixes, and anybody who's made a record will tell you, you know, you take them home and you live with them for a little bit, and there's things you love and there's things you just don't. And I think for whatever reason, there were things that did not work for him on that original solo acoustic, mostly, version. And so he went into Sound 80, the studio in Minneapolis, on the 27th of December, right after Christmas, with some local guys that, you know, basically a pickup band. But they were guys who were really players. They were really well known. These were the A-list guys in Minneapolis, especially Billy Berg and Bill Peterson, who were just amazing players, played with a lot of great people and went on to play with a lot of great people as the backbone bass and drums. So he went in with the intention of just doing one song, of recutting Idiot Wind. And but that very quickly became five songs. You know, I think Idiot Wind went incredibly well. He was really energized by that. It was a sound he hadn't maybe heard since, you know, probably the Highway 61 sessions. It was a really energetic, had a real bounce to it, and conveyed the songs that were dense and emotional songs in a different way. It was a little bit of a left turn. You know, Dylan, by all accounts, loves left turns. And so they kept going. You know, so they ended up doing, I guess it was three on the first night and two on the second night, and that then became Blood on the Tracks.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Let's get back to our conversation with Jeff Slate, who wrote the album notes for the Columbia Records release, Bootleg Sessions Volume 14, More Blood, More Tracks by Bob Dylan.
I was surprised to read in your notes for More Blood, More Tracks, the Bootleg Sessions Volume 14, that even those five tracks that replaced the originals on Blood on the Tracks don't or sound differently on the album than they sound on this new release. That is, they were sped up to a certain extent.
Yeah, well, that was pretty common. You know, I think, you know, you listen to, if you ever get a 45 from, like, you know, on eBay, like a jukebox 45 or in the used record bin, those jukebox 45s, they, and you look at the time, it's like 4 or 5, 10 seconds shorter than the release, you know, the version, you know, from the album. And certainly when they've remastered and gone back to the original analogs, you know, that happened with the Stones, it happened with the Beach Boys. It's very common to give it a little push, a little bounce, especially for AM radio and so forth. And so that was done on these tracks and wasn't all that unusual. But yeah, this is, you know, exactly as close to the way they were recorded and mixed in such a way that, you know, the Phil Ramone mixes on the final record back in 75 had a lot of reverb. And these are, you know, very much like you're in the room with Dylan and the musicians. And the idea was the closer you could get to those performances, the more you'd be able to draw from it as a listener. In other words, you know, a lot of times production gets in the way of hearing the performance and hearing the songs and the lyrics and so forth. And this is not that. You now have his notebook right in front of you. You can see the changes he made. You can hear the inflection. You can hear how they developed over the course of the week in New York and a couple of days in Minneapolis. And it's as close as you can get. And this is what I meant about, you know, the box of documents from Brian Epstein's office. This is as close as you can get to sort of contemporaneous notes from those sessions. You've got the notebook, you've got the session tapes, fairly raw. You can kind of draw, it doesn't matter what I think about them or what I wrote in the liner notes for the most part, you can draw your own conclusion.
The songs also continued their journeys even after the release of Blood on the Tracks, because It seems to me that he sings the songs the way he sings them the one time that the tape was rolling, and then he never sings them that way again. And the box set kind of bears that out because every version is slightly different. And then there's the versions of Idiot Wind and You're a Big Girl Now that were on Hard Rain, and the version of Simple Twist of Fate that he performed on television. And then there's the version of Tangled Up in Blue that he recorded on the live album quite a few years later, continuously reworking them and rethinking them.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there's a box set a couple of years ago called The Cutting Edge, which dealt with the 65-66 era. And on those, he wasn't as sure about what he wanted to do. So a lot of times he was really searching for those songs. I think the difference here was he had a pretty clear idea of how he wanted to approach them. It was more tweaking them. But I think then, like you said, he then releases them and discards them completely. And the way he then performs them, I think what's interesting is if you look at Bob Dylan in early 74 on tour with the band, and Bob Dylan in late 74 on Blood on the Tracks, and then in 1975 on Desire and on the Rolling Thunder Review tour, it's almost four different people. I mean, his delivery, his intensity, the arrangements, the musicians he's choosing, they're all completely different. And I think that's a restless creator. I think I wrote about Tangled Up in Blue for The New Yorker and it's sort of history and development over the years, and one of the things I struck on was Dylan versus other artists. There's this idea of people as sort of presenters or creators, and I likened it to Paul Simon is a presenter. In other words, he toils over his recordings. He's extremely meticulous. He hires the best musicians he can find. He works them and works them and works them, spends endless hours getting just the right take and overdubbing and redubbing and editing until it's perfect, and then that becomes the record. And then he spends, typically, I mean, occasionally he'll rework things, but typically he spends the rest of the time performing that song almost identically to the way it was released on the record. Dylan is a creator. In other words, when he records Tangled Up in Blue, that isn't necessarily the definitive version for him. And I think the way we can see that is there's, I think, eight or so versions of Tangled Up in Blue on the box. They're all a little bit different. And then just a couple of months later on the Rolling Thunder Review tour, it's completely different, and completely different, well, not completely different, but very different lyrics. Again, like you said, you know, in the Hard Rain era, it's much, you know, it's rocked up and raw, and it's almost brutal. By 84, in Real Live, he's completely reworked the song. The chords are different, the story is completely different. And interestingly, he's rewritten it yet again. There are several new versions that he's just written in the last year or so. And when he was in the Far East earlier this year, and now in the Mondo Scripto gallery show he did of his artwork in London, they've got the lyrics to a completely new version that utilizes the same structure and framework, you know, the sort of shell of the story, but it's different again, and it's really Tangled Up in Blue for 2018. It's a more sort of apocalyptic version, maybe a Trump Brexit era version of Tangled Up in Blue. And so this is a guy who is, you know, constantly seeking sort of the next great fix as a creative person. And I think we're lucky to have him. But yeah, to think that the Tangled Up in Blue that you know and love, and that we've all obsessed over for 44 years, that's on the album, you're never going to hear that in concert, but you weren't going to hear that in concert in 1975 either. So that's just the reality of who Bob Dylan is as an artist.
And this new box set is really an amazing glimpse into that creative process, and your contributions are incredibly helpful. And so it's really been a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you about it here on From the Bookshelf. So Jeff Slate, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. It was great.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Joining me now is Francesca Nettle Bauer. She is the daughter of Louise Reiner, who won two Best Actress Oscars in 1936 and 1937. Francesca Nettle Bauer has written a memoir called Scene from the Wings, Louise Reiner, My Mother, The Journey. Francesca Nettle Bauer, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, it's my pleasure to be with you.
You know, I feel like I know you really well. I mean, you know, I know some things, some very detailed things about you. Is it weird for you talking to strangers that have read your book?
Well, the book is very candid, I have to say. What I wrote it for, it's very human. I think it reaches out to a lot of people. It carries a lot of the human element. And that's important in life. Whatever we can create that we can relate to, or that we can have others relate to in any artistic form, is the art form that brings everybody close in life.
You know, a lot of us have mothers. Almost everyone.
And everybody has a mother.
I guess they do. And your book, Francesca Nettle Bauer, it's not surprisingly mostly about you, but part of it is the fact that you had a very long-lived and famous mother. Tell our listeners who may not remember who Louise Reiner was.
Well, Louise Reiner, I'd like to say, was and hopefully still is. She was an extraordinary woman in her time. She was an innovator, immensely creative, came to Hollywood, and without blinking an eye, won two Oscars back-to-back for Best Actress, which she said could have been the worst thing that ever happened to her because she had to remain on that plateau, and so many things happened in her life. But she was a true pioneer in so many ways. She started so much and did so much for so many. What can I say? She worked in the resistance during World War II. She walked off the set at 6 o'clock in the evening and said, I work from such an hour till such and such an hour. 6 o'clock is when we all finish. And it started a unionized trait where for a long time people worked from a given hour to a given hour.
Tell us a little bit about your mother's early career. She was born in Europe.
She was born in northern Germany to a very well-to-do family. They were the biggest silk manufacturers in Germany, as a matter of fact. She wanted very much to be an actress. In those days, according to the society or the social environment that she grew up in, that was like becoming a streetwalker. So she literally left her home, went and lived in the attic of a great aunt of hers who permitted her to, so she could go and pursue her dream, which was acting. So she was working in Austria, in Vienna, doing a play there, and a talent scout had been sent over to Austria to look actually for another actress. He'd been sent by Louis B. Mayer, and he called or telegrammed Louis B. Mayer and said, there's this other girl, Reiner, who you've got to look at, and we got a hat. And so that's how my mother was shipped over, literally, to America. And she agreed to go as long as she was allowed to take her little dog, Scotty, her little Scotty dog with her.
And now, in your book, you describe what I think might be a kind of a Me Too moment where Louis B. Mayer asks her to sit on his lap.
Yes. And she refused. She, nothing bowled her over. And I think she and I were quite alike, like that. We have our own minds, and we're not going to be pummeled by anybody. But she made 9 films that were all very successful, and then she walked away from Hollywood. She had just gone through a very bad marriage with her first husband, Clifford Odets, who was a great writer, one of the great writers of the 20th century. And they had a very tormented marriage, and she walked out of Hollywood. She didn't like it.
And did she ever regret doing that?
I don't know that regret is the right word. I think that she regretted not making more films, although she did do a couple more films after that. She did a lot of stage and theater after that, out of New York and even England.
And she was always famous.
She died famous.
Yeah. And when you were growing up, what was it like to be... So you didn't arrive until long after she had left Hollywood. It was 10 years later, right?
Yeah. It was about 10, 11 years later, yeah. I was born in Manhattan and grew up in Manhattan, and also in... we had another house in Stamford, Connecticut. And then my father was a very prominent publisher and running a big... publishing company in England, and we moved to England. He, being English, wanted to move back to Europe because he felt that he was a European, and said to my mother once, "Darling, we are European. We must move back to Europe." And they did. I grew up there. I adored my mother. And my mother tried to be the best mother she could. She was kind of a mother by the book. But I think in the background of her mind and heart was always her work. I was sent to boarding school, and which was a good thing. I spent most of my formative years in boarding school. And ended up in school in England. I went to school in France. I was at the Royal Ballet School. I moved around quite a bit.
So let me get this straight, Francesca Nettleboyer. Your mother was a movie star, and yet you're saying she never hit you with a wire hanger and told you no wire hangers?
You know, I told Christina Crawford that I thought some of the things she said about her mother were, it may be true, but kind of unfair. I don't want to say I was, you know, in those days, children were spanked. And, I got some pretty bad spankings, but never with a wire hanger, no. The premise of this book, which happens to so many of us, is how I found the personality of my mother in the man that I married, and the personality of my father in another man who I was with before and after my marriage, but who was also close to me during my marriage. And what he did is he smoothed over all the torment and rough edges of my existence with my husband. Like my mother, I loved my husband very deeply. Dare I say, he was the love of my life. My mother, I loved my mother. But they were both very tough on me for the same reasons. They were both insecure, and through insecurity, very often, we have the worst that is brought out of us. And I say, everybody. And these were two very successful, my mother being very beautiful, my husband being extremely handsome, yet they were both very insecure. My husband put my self-worth into the shredder because he was afraid to lose me and wanted to make me dependent. My mother put my self-worth into the shredder because she was very jealous of my possibilities later on in life as another female. She did not want to be overshadowed. My father like the other man in my life, was the man who encouraged me to move forward, to do the things that I ended up doing well. So I found both parents in two men, and I kept on gravitating to that, as so often so many do. And as a result, I finally discovered years and years later what I was doing wrong. And now I'm a very happy woman. And I want to share that with people, that just because I was born of a certain environment, it doesn't mean that we don't all share the same light and darknesses. We are all made of the same cloth. The only difference is sometimes we tend to color our cloths in different shades.
And in your case, you had a famous mother, but nevertheless, she was as infuriating as mothers can be. And oftentimes, it seems to me in your book, she was right about things. Was that especially infuriating?
I don't think anything she was right about was infuriating. And I don't think she was right that often. No, I've got to say, she was not right all the time. However, which brings a point, my mother once said to me, shaking her index finger, which she would often do, "I told you you were going to make a mistake." And you know what I said to her? I said, "Mommy, there is no such thing as mistakes. They're only learning experiences." And I have learned so much through all the valleys that I have fallen into. But I've still jumped off a lot of cliffs that I'm very happy I jumped off of. After all, I think the best thing in life is taking risks. And I took risks, and my risks paid off.
And there's some great hair-raising stories in your book, and I don't want to give them all away, but tell the story about when you had to smuggle some money out of Italy.
I knew you were getting to that. Well, I was a child bride with my first husband. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. However, he was a spoiled rich boy, and I didn't respect that. And therefore, I decided I've got to get out of this marriage, because all of a sudden I was mature and he was still playing Peter Pan. Anyway, I decided that the only way I could get away is if I went as far away as I could without hitting the Far East. I decided to go to California. I went into my closet and I thought, I'm only taking three of everything, three skirts, three sweaters, three nice dresses, whatever one takes, only three of. And I had my daughter, who was then 4 years old, and I told my husband, I'm leaving for America on vacation, because he was leaving on business for somewhere else. I had some dowry money in Switzerland, and that was the only money, because I had my pride stuffed in my pocket, and I wasn't going to ask for anything. So I went with a girlfriend to Switzerland, which was only a 45-minute drive from Milan, and went to the bank where my dowry money, because in those days one was given money as a bride, my dowry money was invested. And I went to the teller. I said, I want to take all my money out. She kind of looked at me funny, and I'm thinking, oh, dear, somebody knows something. But after she went and talked to the director, finally she gave me all the money, which was in cash, which was a very serious amount in those days. We're talking in the early 70s, which then it was quite a few $1,000s. actually 30 to be precise.
Uh-huh.
And I put them in a envelope and got back into the car, where my daughter was in the back seat with my girlfriend's baby, and left. And when we got to the border, we were whistled through by the Swiss, and then all of a sudden stopped by the Italians. and the Italian Border Patrol. And I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, here are two young, in those days, good-looking girls, and no wonder they're going to stop us. Well, they did. They got us out of the car, and I am panicking because I have all this money. And there's a moratorium on currency at that time. So I took them back to the trunk, and I thought, what on earth am I doing? All of a sudden, my girlfriend gets out in a complete panic and says, I've got to get to the Pampers. I've got to get to the Pampers. And, of course, we had Pampers in the trunk of the car. And she gets a Pamper out, and the patrolman was nonplussed at all this confusion. And then they go into the car to look, and I couldn't find the money anywhere. And I thought, oh, my God, where did I put the money? Where did I put it? They're going to find the money. We were waved away. Everything was okay. They waved us on. And I looked at my girlfriend, and I said, where's the money? I don't know where the money is. She said, oh, it's okay. It's in Camilla's diapers. And we took off. And all of a sudden, I hear sirens behind me, and it was one of these patrolmen coming behind me. I'm thinking, oh, my God, they know everything. They know everything. Well, he came up, and he said, you know you left your wallet on the trunk of the car. It hadn't flown off. And he gave me the trunk and waved this on. And that was one of the most heart-beating moments I've ever had.
I can imagine. So your mother being a famous actress, you toyed with acting, but did you ever seriously want to become a star?
No. Did I want to become a star? First of all, I never thought about acting as becoming a star. I thought it was, you know, an art form. I looked up to it. I wanted to be a ballerina. But much later on, I did decide that, you know, maybe I'll play with this, and I got involved in repertory theater in Princeton University when my first husband was there collecting another degree because he didn't want to go to work. And I found myself being chosen to be on the stage for a big repertory performance of The Tempest, which is only one of the most difficult, but Miranda and the Tempest is like Hamlet in Hamlet. And I succeeded in that, but I was never hungry enough to be an actress. You have to be really hungry for any profession in order to succeed. And my hunger is in the writing form. It's not in the acting form. Although I have often thought I'd like to package deals. I would love to put together a film project. That I would be interested in doing. But otherwise, no, I have never been hungry to be an actress. My mother was very fearful that I would be. A director came to the house once when I was about 15 years old. And I can't remember what the movie was, but he wanted me to do the part that made Jean Seberg a big star. And my mother said, no, she can't do this part. She's in school. So I never did it. Who knows?
What types of film projects would you like to produce?
I think my book would make a very interesting film.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I think so, too. It's got all kinds of stuff.
There's a lot of excitement. Nothing held back.
Yeah,
it's a page-turner, as I've heard from many people say. It's a page-turner. I had a friend of mine call me, and she had somebody that she knew that who picked up the book and was screaming at her, saying, why did you give me this book? I'm supposed to be in bed at 10 o'clock. It's 3 in the morning, and I'm still up reading this book. I can't put it down.
Well, I couldn't put it down.
I have no idea who that person was, but she told me the story.
Well, the book is called Scene from the Wings, Louise Reiner, My Mother, The Journey. And the author, my guest, Francesca Nettle-Bauer, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us about the book.
Well, it was my pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.